Well, obviously, trying to deal with market economics in 45 minutes is even worse than trying to deal with it in an hour. And what I'll have to do is to try and touch on some aspects of market economics and allow you to come in from the floor to fill in the missing parts. Obviously, in discussing this subject, we start from the premise that capitalism itself is a stage in the development of human history. In fact, it's quite, it's only been around, 250 years or so, very short time, compared to the development of the human race itself. However, when you listen to different bourgeois economists, they see this, that capitalism is the most perfect way in which human society can organize itself. There may be this or that fault, but generally speaking, it's only through the market and only through vested interests that you can actually organize human society. Clearly, we don't agree with that. And it's not because it's from a moral point of view, although there are many moral arguments you could use against the injustices of capitalism. But the fact of the matter is that capitalism itself has really exhausted its role as an economic system that can deliver a reasonable living standard to the majority of people, we would say. In fact, capitalism has done us enormous service insofar as it has developed the productive forces, industry, technique, and science, to such a degree on a world scale that it's laid the basis for a new society itself. That is social society, meaning the planning of resources, the involvement in the running of society by the mass of the population, and the planned development of society in the interests of the majority, and not run in the interests of a minority for profit reasons. Of course, capitalism itself won't die of its own volition, will just fall apart and that's the end of it. It will struggle to maintain itself because there are vested interests in maintaining capitalism, that is the ruling class itself. And the ruling class is enormously powerful, has control of all the mass media, of education, the means of manipulating public opinion, and it will try its best, despite the breaking down of the system, to make sure that it remains alive and fulfills their particular interests. Of course, capitalism cannot exist simply by force. You know, that we terrorize people to believe in capitalism. But capitalism has to win over, at least have the consent of people. If not the overwhelming majority, at least a good proportion of the population. And the only way it can do that is not only by propaganda, but also delivering certain living standards, really, for people who would see it as acceptable. Now, I do bear in mind that I am now classified in as part of the older generation, because I was brought up in the 1950s and the 1960s, times of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and everybody laughing there. But in that period, that was kind of the heyday, I would say, of post-war capitalism, insofar as it looked, and not just looked, it proved that it was different from the interwar period of crisis, mass unemployment, war, fascism, all the evils that you could expect. All those seemed to disappear in the post-war period. Mass unemployment disappeared, poverty began to fall, living standards started to increase for the majority of people. My working class background, we had a council house, we had eventually had carpets on the floor, so to speak, fridges, all the modern technology that went with the increase in living standards, even holidays and holidays abroad. These things improved things, from the point of view of the working class in a real way, as opposed to the horrors of the 1930s that your father or grandfather or grandmother, whatever you want to call it, used to talk about. And therefore you brought in the idea, really, that capitalism had changed. And that was the propaganda poured out left, right and centre. And of course, look, it works. Capitalism works. All we had to do is really adopt a new policy, usually called Keynesianism, where we could basically, where there was dips in the economy, we could support the economy and bring it back into an equilibrium. And therefore, capitalism works. Capitalism means rising living standards. It means also that we're all going to become middle class at a certain point in time. That was the philosophy, not only of the capitalists, but also the reformists in the labour and trade union movement. They all bought into capitalism in reality. And the reason for that is it seemed as if capitalism could deliver the goods. The capitalists were able to give more than a few crumbs, if you like, off the table to the working class insofar as reforms were granted. The National Health Service was mentioned yesterday. That was an enormous advance. Nationalisations took place in certain basic industries. They said that the capitalists didn't really rule things. Now, it was managers who ruled things, and therefore there was a managerial form of society, more democratic, not really geared to profit so much. And therefore, you know, gradually things are changing for the better, and the reformists, the socialist reformist politicians would even say, eventually, bit by bit, we'll change society and it'll become socialism. But these ideas sunk very deeply into the population, I would say, because it appeared to be correct. And Marxism, bloody hell, Marxism was seen as a obsolete kind of theories related to the 19th century of no real bearing on modern society itself. In fact, I haven't got it here, I got a quote from it. I thought it was a very good little book called Marx on Economics. It was a Blue Penguin book, and extracts of all different Marx's writings. Well worth getting, it's out of print, unfortunately. But the introduction's quite funny because it was written in the 1960s. And the guy who was writing the introduction said the following. The next result has been that Western capitalism today is far different from the system analysed by Marx. Marx had failed to take account of capitalism's ability to change and become a far more humane system. The experience of the last two decades, remind you this was written in the mid-1960s, has made a mockery of the reserve army of the unemployed as a force permitting capitalists to grind down the conditions of the unemployed workers. In much of Western Europe and in the United States, there has been comparatively little unemployment. And that was really the reality of life at that particular time. There were debates, and if Nigel Pearce was here, he always makes his contribution. He's a miner at the time. He says, well, when I was in school, they talked about automation, and we were all discussing how we would actually spend our leisure time in the future, this wonderful leisure time we were going to get. So company's capitalism was fundamentally changed. At the time, of course, those who put forward a Marxist position were fighting against the stream because it didn't look as if Marxism, or what Marx wrote, was real. In fact, Ted Grant, who was the founder of the tendency, he brought out a pamphlet in 1960 called Will There Be a Slump, which analysed capitalism at that point and said, well, look, you cannot just look at the surface of events. You have to understand capitalism, the nature of capitalism. And he went into it to analyse the fact that capitalism was able to overcome its problems because of a particular certain set of circumstances. After the war, the working class had been defeated after an attempted revolution because of the betrayal of the social democratic leaders and the Stalinists. And capitalism was given a new lease of life. Because of the destruction of the Second World War, they had to rebuild the economies. There was the Marshall Aid, which America pumped in billions of dollars into the re-establishing European economy. the Americans, who came out of the war as one of the victors, also imposed upon the rest of the capitalist world certain things, that the dollar was going to be the international currency. After all, two-thirds of the world's gold reserves was in Fort Knox. They called a conference in 1944, called the Bretton Woods Conference, and they redrew the international laws as they saw it, where they would bring free trade, as opposed to the 1930s, which were all these tariff barriers and restrictions. They would now sweep away the restrictions, they would lower tariff barriers, they would stimulate world trade, together with all the other factors of the post-war, destruction of the post-war in the war. And over a number of these factors came together to act not as a small little stimulus, but a massive stimulus which expanded capitalism into an upswing, not just a boom, an upswing that lasted 25 years. And capitalism in that period was able to overcome its contradictions that it had in the past, or at least partially overcome them. Mass unemployment was done away with. Living standards rose. All these things were fitted into this new development of capitalism. However, the question was this post-war period now the norm? Was this normality? Or was it just a prelude to another period? In other words, was it just an aberration? Was it an area which was not, a period of time which was not normal at all for capitalism? And it would revert to the normality at a later period. Now, when we were arguing in the 1960s, it was hard for us to counteract, you know, because the facts, we used to argue on the basis of facts, figures, and so on. Therefore, to try and argue that capitalism was in crisis, which it wasn't, was obviously a difficult thing to do. But our task then was to explain that the laws of capitalism hadn't fundamentally changed. That still, the capitalist class ruled, that it based its system on maximization of profit, and the only way it could extract profit was from the exploitation of the working class itself. And although the national income had been, mainly because of the strength of the working class, I would add, after the Second World War, that the national income began to not be as crudely ill-divided as in the 1920s and 30s, the working class were getting a slice of the cake, if you like, a bit bigger than it was in the 30s, but the cake was getting much bigger. The capitalists were making a big killing. They were really enjoying the fruits of this massive increase in production, in real wealth. And we would say, and Marx himself would say, and he did too in the Communist Manifesto, which I could quote, that capitalism revolutionized the planet, revolutionized society in a distorted way, developed the basis for socialism, the material basis for socialism. And when these people said in the past that Marxism was obsolete, that Marxism didn't fit into the realities as they were, then we would say, well, that's not correct. In fact, we will be proved to be correct on the basis of events. So at the end of the day, you could ask, I mean, Trotsky asked in a pamphlet he wrote in Marxism and Our Time, where he said, well, Marxism, is it just a kind of historical interest, like the writings of Adam Smith or David Ricardo? You know, was it like that? Or did it have a real bearing on how capitalism would develop? And Trotsky explained, well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. That it's the reality that you will determine whether a theory is correct or not. And it looked as if in the 1950s and 60s that capitalism, Marxism was obsolete, that it didn't correspond to the realities of the time. However, as Ted Grant explained, not to look at the surface of events, but look at the contradictions of capitalism and how they would manifest themselves at a certain point in time. He wrote this document in 1960-61. He couldn't put a date on it. He didn't say next year is going to be a crisis or the year after. All he said was in the coming period, there will be, this period of upswing will be replaced by an enormous downswing of capitalism. Of course, we had to wait a little bit longer than a couple of years. We had to wait until 1975, which is the biggest crisis that capitalism faced since the war. But even then, production on the world scale only fell by 0.5%, a little small amount. But there was enough to shake the confidence of the ruling class everywhere. And above all, it was very important insofar as it marked the end of the post-war upswing of capitalism. It marked the end of that era and opened up a new era for capitalism, more corresponding with the difficulties of capitalism, because at that time, 1974-75 crisis, gave rise to the return of mass unemployment again, not only in Britain, but America, throughout Europe, everywhere. In other words, that capitalism now was reverting to its old contradictory ways, if you like, revealed in this the inability of capitalism to really use the forces that it had brought into being. This was a very important juncture. In fact, from 1975 onwards, you'll find that capitalism is not able to this very day to catch up with or repeat the kind of investment figures, employment figures, profitability figures that they had in the 1950s and early 1960s, the so-called golden era of capitalism. They couldn't get it back. So the whole period from 1975 onwards to today was opening up a new period of decline for capitalism, where the curve, if you like, of capitalist development, where it developed after the First World War, was now in its descent. And as a result, the difficulties for capitalism began to emerge, the contradictions began to emerge, and basically the capitalists were looking for different ways now in which to make the system work for them better. In other words, growing contradictions was forcing them even to change the economic policy, which really for 25 years after the war was based on Keynesianism, which is budget deficits basically, which meant that the state was just producing money to keep the economy moving. However, that would lead to inflation, because if we kept producing more and more money into the economy without necessary goods, you'll cause inflation to occur. And did in the 1970s, you had the biggest inflationary crisis for capitalism, well, in its history really, apart from individual countries like in Germany, and that, it was an international global phenomenon where prices were rising by 10, 15, 20, 25%, which is very, very dangerous for capitalism. But the slump in 74-75 meant they abandoned that program and they moved now towards what they classified as monetarism. And monetarism really was nothing new. It was the economic policies that they had pursued in the interwar period, of policies of deflation, of balanced budgets, of basically cutting the living standards of the working class, not by inflation but by deflation. But for the working class, it made no difference because it was the same. It was death by different means, basically. So capitalism had entered this new period after 1975 of great difficulties. However, we could say, even before that, and looking back from now, you can quite see it quite clearly, that Marx himself foresaw these developments. Not in the extremes, probably, that we see today, but certainly outlined all the main tendencies of the development of capitalism. And he did that even in the basic pamphlet that Marx and Engels wrote of the Communist Manifesto, which is certainly the most relevant document at this time. When you consider it was written in 1847, 1848, you'll find that at the time no other document, no other book, no other piece of literature produced at that time could ever saw the developments of capitalism as the Communist Manifesto. And even when you read it now, you are kind of taken back at how far these two young communists were able to see into the future and the tendencies they foresaw that would develop. I got my old copy of the manifesto here. I mean, just to quote one piece, I think it's quite appropriate. Capitalism has created enormous cities, has greatly increased the urban population. In fact, that rings a bell. Did you see Andrew Marr program the other night? A couple of nights ago. Talking about super cities, is it? Or these mega cities, 21 mega cities. Capitalism has now brought into being cities of 10 million, of 15, of 20, of 30 million. A vast majority, a majority of the population on world scale now live in cities and towns as opposed to the rural areas. Again, Marx understood how this was developing because of the development of capitalism. It has agglomerated population, centralized the means of production, and has concentrated property in a few hands. That's quite clear. The bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarcely 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than of all preceding generations put together. Well, that was written in 1848. Today, we look back a further 150 years, you can see the colossal developments of capitalism on a world scale. Again, foresaw by Marx and Engels at that time. He goes on to explain, which again is worth pointing out, the bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production. They are forced, unlike other forms of society, slavery or feudalism. Capitalism is a very revolutionary form of society, much more by necessity having to produce and accumulate for the sake of accumulation. In the strive for gaining more profit, more resources, capitalism is forced, because of the laws of capitalism, to embrace accumulation all the time. There's no end to it. And with that change, I remember, I think it was 15 years ago, I attended a trade union conference. It was the AWU, I think it was. And they had some managers there from power energy companies. And they were lecturing the shop stewards about the need for change. And one of the shop stewards said, okay, there's been an enormous amount of change now in the last 20 years. When's this change going to end? And the bourgeois represents that. It'll never end. It is with us eternally. And the faces of some of the stewards was completely shattered, you know, because they thought, hang on, there must be some stability here. There must be some end to this process. No, there's no end to it. There's constant change. Not only in countries, but on a world scale. In reason to technique of forms of production, of methods of production, in order that the capitalists, because they are forced to, they need to exploit and squeeze out to the maximum every ounce of labour they can from the working class in order to produce surplus value. And that drives them to revolutionise, as explained by Marx 150 years ago, the productive forces itself. He goes on to explain, constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social relations, everlasting uncertainty, and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. The bourgeoisie has through its exploitation of the world market given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. Goes on. It compels all nations, on pain of extinction, to adopt the bourgeois mode of production. It compels them to introduce what it calls civilization into their midst, i.e., to become bourgeois themselves. In one word, it creates a world after its own image. I mean, that's globalization to a T. That's the character of capitalism we're now living in. And particularly over the last 20 to 30 years, there's been an intensification of this process. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of Stalinism, opened up these areas for capitalism. The movement of China into the world market, the opening up of China for capitalism, again, allowed new fields of investment, exploiting the current fields of investment, all this drive more and more and more to replicate itself everywhere into an intensified, unified world order under capitalism. And with that, obviously, growth has taken place of a centralization and concentration of capital. Marx explained when he was writing it at that time, the big debate in the 1840s was free trade. You know, the only way forward is free trade and so on. And Marx explained, well, you know, free trade, yes, that gives rise to monopolies. That competition is a fundamental ingredient of capitalism. And what it means, though, is not only a competition to squeeze everything out of the working class, but also competition between the capitalists in order to defeat one, in order to gain extra markets, gain an extra share of the market to increase their profits as opposed to someone else's profits. And therefore this enormous rivalry opens up. And although it is true that this is the epoch of monopoly capitalism, this is the epoch of imperialism, as Lenin explained, it is the highest stage of capitalism, does that mean that competition has been eradicated? No, it's not been eradicated. It's been twisted, it's been mangled, it's been sharpened. It's a real dog-eat-dog form of competition between nations and huge multinational corporations in the form of possibly of trade wars. Everything has gone up a scale. If you like what Marx is writing, if Marx is alive today, he could see the tendencies he was concerned about, but they've gone to extremes. They've really become over-intensified, if you like. And the capitalists themselves are always seeking a way out, because they compete with others, of how to squeeze out more unpaid labour for the work from the working class. Because as Marx explained, that their value comes from the labour of the working class. That new value comes from the exploitation of the working class. You know, you can have a factory and you can have the brand new machinery and you can have and lots of components and lots of raw materials. You can sit there and watch them till the cows come home. They'll not produce an extra degree of or extra amount of value. In fact, they will devalue. They will rust. They will become inoperative. They will decay. It's only when you have the application of human labour that you see the development of new values. They're able to reshape the products, reshape the resources into millions of different commodities which are spewed onto the world market. Of course, capitalism is an anarchist system of production that is blind. The laws of capitalism certainly exist, but they operate behind the backs of society. And above all, they exist this fundamental law, which Marx explained, of the law of value, that resources are allocated on the basis of the law of value, that commodities are produced on the basis of the law of value, that they are determined, what is accepted and what is rejected on the world market, it depends upon the law of value, which in reality means that commodities are made up of the labor of the working class, the amount of effort and time and energy is put into those commodities on an average way, in other words, the amount of socially necessary labor determines their value itself. That these are put onto the market, and whether they are sold or not sold, because there's no guarantee, will determine whether they reach that criterion or be able to fulfill, or whether they're able to realize the value that exists within them. So the capitalist class spews out these commodities, but they have to gain a greater share of a market. In what way? They have to gain a greater share of the market by reducing the costs of production in order to undermine and compete with their competitors. And they do this by attempting to reduce the amount of value contained in each particular commodity. They do this by reducing the labor time it takes to produce a commodity. And how do they do that? They do it in various ways. So they do it by increasing the exploitation of the working class. So whereas a worker may have taken yesterday, in former times, an hour to produce 100 commodities, today is new machinery is introduced. His work pattern is changed. The exploitation is increased, so he produces 200 commodities within that hour, and thereby can reduce the costs of each particular commodity itself. That's how they engage in competition on a world scale. That's how they undermine their competitors, by reducing the amount of time it takes to produce a commodity. Of course, this is a very contradictory way of developing society and fulfilling the needs of society. The working class, after all, although, in passing, there are lots of things we could say, but it's important to understand, as I said a bit earlier, it's the working class that produces new labour. And the working class does not sell to the capitalist his labour. He sells to the capitalist his ability to work, which Marx explained was his labour power. And you go to the capitalist because you have no alternative. The capitalist owns the means of production. Over the period of the last 300, 400, 500, 600 years, the capitalist has robbed, they've pirated, they've stolen, and have monopolized the means of production. They've driven the peasantry off the land. They've separated out, if you like, which happened before, the means of production from the population. They have now monopolized it. And therefore the workers, who have no means of production, have to sell the only thing they have, which is their ability to work, in order to live and survive. And they have to do that by selling themselves for wages to the capitalists. The capitalist then takes their efforts, brings the workers into the factory. Basically, the working day is divided, as Marx explained, into two. The working day, in effect, is necessary labour and surplus labour. So part of the working day, the workers put to work, and he produces, he or she produces, enough values that will cover the wages that worker is paid for that day's labour. Just say, for sake of argument, it's 4 hours worth of labour is produced, which covers their wages. But in the factory, you know, a bell doesn't go off and say, "Oh, no, mate, you know, pack up work, you know, you've covered your wages." But the capitalists say, "Hang on, we got a contract here, you work for a further 4 hours. It's an 8-hour day, you work for a further 4 hours for me." So you keep, the factory, you keep producing, and in the next 4 hours they produce surplus value. They produce surplus labour, if you like, that division. That's always been there, by the way, in any class society. You can go back to slave society. The slaves, although it appears differently, they obviously, because they're owned by the slave owner, and it appears that all their labour is surplus labour, that everything they produce is just surplus. But it isn't, because the slave has to eat, has to survive for the next day. So even a small part of their working day has to be used in order to make the necessary sustenance for them to survive. And the feudalism is pretty clear, right? Because the basis of feudalism is land ownership by the lords. That the serf is tied to the land. The serf has their own land to work on, but they do that for only a certain proportion of the day or the week. Say half the week is to produce on their own land so they can keep themselves and their families together. But the rest of the week or the rest of the day or whatever the month, they will work on the Lord's land, completely separated in time and space. And you can see quite clearly, necessary labour, that's when they produce enough to survive, and surplus labour, what they produce as surplus value for the land, for the Lord. Because under capitalism, this relationship is covered up, it's disguised. Because as I said, there's no bell in the factory that goes off and says, hang on a minute, 4 hours, you've covered your wages now, and now you're going to produce surplus value. On the contrary, the capitalists say basically, no, I pay you for your wages, that's what you give to me, I pay you for your labour, which is not true. They only pay for their ability to work, and that's the way surplus value is created by the working class itself. But they have to come, because of competition, they have to bring in new technique, and they do this primarily by machinery. And machinery itself is a means of increasing the productivity of labour. And that's quite clear in the sense of, in the past, those on the land, agricultural labourers, could produce a small amount of crops on the basis of hand tools. Or in the workshop, they could work by producing things by hand tools. Whereas when they go into a factory, or if they've got a big combine harvester, or they've got masses of machinery at their elbow, they can produce, their productivity of labour is increased enormously. And we see that in all aspects of production over the past 50 years, 100 years or so. So the introduction of machinery increases the productivity of labour. But the machinery itself doesn't add extra value. What the machine does is intensifies the exploitation of the labourer itself, or the worker itself. It increases the productivity of the worker, who can produce far more commodities now with the assistance of machinery than they did in the past. The only thing is that the capitalists who bring in machinery cost them a lot of money. You know, it's all very well producing, having a small, saw and a hammer and whatever, but bringing in a lathe on a big, large machine costs a lot of money. And therefore, although it lowers the costs of production and you can produce more things, you have to sell a hell of a lot more in order to cover your costs. And that gives that brings about the contradiction. Also, the machinery, which for any normal, I would say normal, for any rational society, would certainly be used to lighten the burden of work, machinery in the hands of the capitalist intensifies work, increases the stress enormously on the worker, and they bring in different techniques. So machinery, rather than being a liberator, which is obviously under socialism it would be, under socialism, machinery would be used to lighten the burden of work, reduce the hours you have in work, and you're going to have a lot of leisure time. And the capitalism, it's the opposite. The machine has to be used, as far as they're concerned, 24 hours a day. They have to get their monies out of this machine. And if the machine is lying idle, then obviously it's not producing any value, or not helping to produce any value. It's not covering any costs. So they are forced, right, by necessity, to increase the hours of work of the worker. Well, of course, a worker can only work 24 hours, or can't work 24 hours. You have to sleep. You have to have a bit of rest. There are certain physical limits. But the capitalists overcome this by basically bringing in shift work. Not just overtime, which increases, but shift patterns are introduced. Continental workings, three shift patterns, all different types, are used in order to keep the machinery going for 24 hours a day. And the reason for that is, when it was a new machine, it raised the productivity of labour enormously, and they produced a lot of goods with it. The working class was exploited more. That's no problem with that. The danger is, though, and you're able to not just only do that, you're producing goods which are cheaper, cost less than their competitors. So you'll steal a bigger share of the market over your competitors. The only thing is that competitors can introduce machinery. They can produce a better machine maybe, you know, in 6 months' time or a year's time. That can undercut you because they can produce even cheaper than you can produce. So you don't want to be left with a machine you paid for, which in effect is obsolete because new machinery has been brought in much more effective than your own. So you, as a capitalist, are forced to try and use this machine until it drops as quickly as possible. And the machine is called depreciation. The amount of value created by taken over by the machine raw materials is constant. It's just the amount of value that exists at that time. The machine, if you like, shaves away a small element of its life, of its usefulness, over a long period of time. And this depreciation is then carried over into the commodities that it produces. So the capitalists are very concerned about not having machinery which is going to be obsolete. So they have to work it to death, but in the process they work the working class to death. And they bring in new technology. I mean, Fordism was brought in what, the early part of the 19th century. A big advance, they saw it as on, as opposed to small factory production. This line production was much more effective, but it meant that the division of labour was greater and greater. So each worker, rather than having an input in the development of the commodities, really, they obviously do have an input, but they have a smaller and smaller input in relation to the division of labour. Perhaps you just be turning the screw, putting the screw in, and then it goes along the line. Someone else puts someone else in. You saw that fantastic film, which is well worth seeing again, Modern Times by Charlie Chaplin, which epitomised the way in which the workers were exploited in the 1930s by Fordism, and how they felt part of the machine. They felt, and that's the that's what machinery does under capitalism, that the worker is just an auxiliary to the machine, part of the machine itself, in effect, and therefore it becomes the machine is the master, rather than we are a master of the machine. And that's the inevitability under capitalism itself. The only problem is that these greater amounts of machinery is introduced, the greater amounts of capital that is introduced, the smaller is the percentage of the workforce. And if the workforce are the only means of producing value, then there's a decline, I won't go into it in too much detail, in the rate of profit over a period of time. Because although that is true, and it's a lot, and this happens over a long period of time, in the 1960s and 1970s, right till the beginning of the 1980s, there was a declining rate of profit for the capitalists because of this contradiction. They had invested so much in constant capital, so much in factories and machinery and so on, as opposed to the workers themselves. And that rate of profit slid. But the capitalists there were determined to increase the rate of profit, and they could do this in a different way. Marx called it a tendency for the rate of profit to decline. And the reason why it was a tendency, there are a whole host of other factors that can, are countervailing factors that can even either stop it or even reverse it. And that's what has happened over the last 30 years. The rate of profit has increased in all the main capitalist countries. Why? Because of the enormous attack on the working class over that period. They squeezed the working class. They've used mass unemployment to intimidate the working class. They have, reversed this tendency to fall. I had a quote here, I don't know if I could find it now, but it summed up the battle of the 1980s. It's a quote from Alan Budd. Alan Budd was the one of the economic advisors to Margaret Thatcher. And he wrote a biography, and this is what he said about the 1980s attacks on the working class. I quote, The 1980s policies of attacking inflation by squeezing the economy and public spending were a cover to bash the workers. Raising unemployment was a very desirable way of reducing the strength of the working class. What was engineered, in Marxist terms, he says, was a crisis of capitalism, which recreated a reserve army of labour and allowed the capitalists to make high profits ever since. That's not partially, it's partially correct, but nevertheless, it's an indication of this counter-revolution by the capitalists against the working class over the last 30 years. And therefore, there's been an intensification of labour. There's been a greater proletarianisation of labour internationally as well. And these are the tendencies in which capitalism is moving towards. Mass unemployment has been here now for the last 30-odd years. The biggest problem they have is that capitalism will not die of its own. It is made up of enormous amounts of contradictions, if that is true, but the capitalists to overcome those contradictions temporarily, but only on the expense of giving way to greater contradictions in the future. And that's one of the problems they faced in the last economic crisis of 2008-2009. That was, again, a watershed for world capitalism, and it introduced a new phase, because in the past, recoveries took place. After 1974-75, there was a recovery of capitalism. In the United States economy grew in the first three quarters by 6-8%. Big recovery. Unemployment went down. It was a general recovery. That didn't last. But one of the reasons why they were able to sustain this capitalism for a whole historical period was because of credit. This massive increase in credit, which allows capitalism to go beyond its limits, to overcome its contradictions for the time. Of course, credit has to be paid back with interest, and we see this huge bubble that was created artificially by capitalism, particularly in the previous 10, 15 years prior to the slump, which allowed capitalism to find new markets, to intensify things. But sooner or later, it was going to come down, it was going to be a crash of enormous proportions, as was explained yesterday, a crash of overproduction. The only time in human society where you can have a system that produces too much and causes a crisis, as opposed to too few and causing a crisis, as you had under slavery and feudalism. They had a plague, or they had a bad harvest, and people starved. Today you produce too much, and that's why people starve, because of capitalism and the need for profit at the end of the day. The big problem that capitalism has is that, by its very logic, it cannot, the working class cannot buy back all the value that it has created. It's impossible. But the only way the system is able to survive is that the capitalists expropriate the surplus value and reinvest it. But the problem is, when you reinvest, you create more and more and more productive potential for the market. And as Engels explained quite correctly, the laws of production are more stimulated, are more dynamic than the laws of the market, which are more sluggish. And you can have periodically a crisis of realization that they cannot sell their goods because the market itself is limited and produces a crisis of overproduction. Not only have we this crisis of overproduction, but capitalism, the crisis seems to be ongoing. And this, it is down here, I'll show you. Picked it up in the radio station last week. What Recovery, Time magazine, and explained it here about, by the way, talking about profits are at record levels. Record levels. Unemployment, also at record levels. In the past, you would thought, big rise in profits, big investment, you know, unemployment would go, no. Big profits, but it's not carried into benefits for the mass of the population, if you like. And there's a job crisis now in America. There's a job crisis in Europe. The capitalism has reached its limits, if you like. Yes, it can last and go on indefinitely. at the expense of the working class. But not like in the 1950s. They say that's gone. Now it's a period like the 1930s and the 1920s of enormous polarization of wealth. You know, the top 1% of the population, the ruling class, has 24% of the national income. The same proportion as just before the crash of 1929. All these things are factors which come into the equation. The capitalism is reaching its limits. But they will not collapse. It'll just mean horror without end. Our living standards will plummet. Whatever, even in the richest countries. And the working class will be made to suffer on the basis of capitalism. Only by the overthrow of capitalism and the rational planning of these resources on a world scale would allow a way out. Not only a way out, it would be a superabundance for the working class. Reducing the working day. You know, why work 10 hours or 12 hour shifts? Why not work for 3, 4, 5 hours a day? And allow the time for the workers to be involved in the running of society. Allow them to use their talent. Abolish unemployment. All those things are possible on the basis of the productive potential acquired to us by capitalism. But they cannot be done on the basis of capitalist ownership. It can only be done by abolishing capitalism and the contradictions of capitalism and planning rationally the resources of society for the majority, for the interests of the majority. Anyway, my time is not only up, it's well over, so I'll leave it there. Thank you.